It's a beautiful morning.
Good morning, Barcelona. You're listening to English Radio on RKB 106.9 FM. I'm Virgil, today, tomorrow, and forever. Welcome to Thursday. It's a good day. It's nice and cold, it's bright, it's sunny, and it's going to be an interesting day without question. Well, as you know, as we move into the new year, we always start trying to allocate time for work, for vacations, for more play, or just time to enjoy life. But invariably at the end of the year, we say, where did the time go? In many cases, we haven't really lost track of time, but rather have had time stolen from us. Our guest today, Cosimo Danaritzer, is the director of, to me, a very interesting documentary called Time Thieves. Welcome to the show, Cosimo.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I think the thing that you know we're talking about, it's relevant on many, many levels. Time is that ephemeral thing we all try to get a hold of. But tell me how the concept for the documentary came about.
Well, exactly what you said earlier. We all complain about not having enough time. Where did time go? And I was sort of wondering, on the one hand, everybody tells me they have no time. Time is running away. On the other hand, we're doing, we have these really, really right. busy days. And then I was at the airport one day and I thought, I've printed out my boarding pass. I've done all the booking. Now I'm in a queue and I'm checking in my luggage myself. I'm not talking to a human being. I'm talking to a machine here. And who's doing all the work? And, they're charging me an admin fee. And then I think I've done half of that job. And then I started noticing there's a lot more of that going on. And I was sort of wondering, actually, are they stealing our time from us? And where does it really go? And that's sort of how it started. So that's really the question, the question we all have. Where does time go? And it goes many different ways. And it's going sort of new places now as well.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's an interesting topic. We'll be back to talk more with you right after this.
I got this feeling inside my bones. It goes electric, wavy when I turn it on. All through my city, all through my home. We're flying up no ceiling when we get in our zone. Got that sunshine in my pocket. Got that good soul in my feet. I feel that hot blood in my body when it drops. Ooh, I can't take my eyes off of it. Moving so phenomenally. Ooh, unlock the way we rock it. So don't stop.
Under the lights when everything goes. Nowhere to hide when I'm getting you close. When we move, well, you already know. So just imagine.
Nothing I can see but you when you dance, dance, dance. Feel the good day creeping up on you. So just dance, dance, dance. Come on now. All the things I shouldn't do but you dance, dance, dance. And ain't nobody leaving soon, so keep dancing. Just dance, dance, dance. Ooh, it's something magical. It's in the air, it's in my blood, it's rushing on. Don't need no reason, don't need control. I fly so high, no ceiling when I'm in my zone. Cause I got that sunshine in my pocket. Got that good soul in my feet. I feel that hot blood in my body when it drops. Can't take my eyes off of it. Moving so phenomenally. On like the way we rock it. So don't stop.
Under the lights when everything goes. Nowhere to hide when I'm getting you close. When we move, well, you already know. So just imagine.
So just
just dance, 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 dance. Come on, dance, all the things I shouldn't do, but you dance, 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 dance. There ain't nobody leaving soon, so keep dancing.
Take a breather?
Nope.
No. So dance on the ceiling, down to the floor. Dance away your troubles, they won't be back no more. So dance what you feel, and even if you don't, dance, baby, dance, baby.
Just feel it, just dance,
dance, dance.
And that was Can't Stop the Feeling by Take Six, and we got a good feeling going here. Now, you begin the movie, Casino, talking about how capitalism monetizes the wages and lives of the workers within the system. I mean, Karl Marx talked about this many, many years ago, and he talked about capitalism as a continuing struggle between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. How does this reconcile with the premise of the movie?
Well, time and capitalism are very, very closely linked. And this starts with the fact that when we work, we're basically selling our time for money. And then with this money, we do other things. We buy food or pay the rent or whatever. So time's like a resource. I'll sell this resource to you. You run a factory and then you get my time and I will work for you and produce things that you can then sell to somebody else, whatever. So it's like it's an exchange, but it basically puts those who are in a buyer's market as a disadvantage because there's a lot of people around with time on their hands, even though our own time sort of is very limited. We should never forget that. But there's a lot of people. There's also a lot of people in low-wage countries sort of competing. So there's a lot of sort of very cheap time available. So it's actually really difficult, I think, for workers to defend that resource. I mean, on the one hand, it's very much yours, but it sometimes sort of feels like everybody wants it.
Well, they wanted the whole thing. As I look at it, you know, we're saying, you know, the low wage countries, but in fact, we are not assigning a equitable value for the amount of work that's given or the amount of wages that the people are being paid. We're saying, okay, if it takes an hour to produce a certain part that goes into a car, well, fine, it may cost $25 in Detroit, but maybe cost $5 in Mexico. But the value that ultimately is contributed to the overall vehicle, the car itself, is the same. It's going to be the same. We don't see cars being made cheaper. We see that profits are increasing for the auto industry.
Yes, of course, because we're not only in capitalism, we're also in a culture of middlemen. We have these kind of big chains, so there's a lot of profit being made on the way, and as you say, maybe the product costs the same and then somebody keeps the money they're saving on the way. And I think this creates also a lot of inequality in a way, because if somebody, regardless where they are on the planet, gets paid very little for their hour, then they've been given very little for their time, and then they can't buy as much also, because if you sell your time, then you use that money for something else, and then maybe normally, you know, you can buy a service, or, you know, if you say, I've had a really long, busy day, well, today I'm going to eat out. So you can not only buy things that you want, you can also buy time back in a way. And if your wages are really low, the lower they are, the less you can do that, and the more you're stuck with working basically all your waking hours. And that's where you get into democracy in a way, because that's where, when you don't have any free time, it's not that, you know, only that you come home and you don't have to clean and cook and whatever. you can't participate in society. You can't go to a political meeting. You haven't, maybe you haven't got time to read the papers. Maybe you want to go to and meet some friends and, you know, have a beer and talk about what's happening right now. So it also leads to a sort of social exclusion. So something I learned from one of my characters in the film, Fabienne, who's here in Catalonia fighting for a different use of time in society, is that it's very much linked to democracy in a way. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about the right to healthcare and education and all that, but I think we should also add the right to a minimum of free time to that for everybody, regardless what they get paid per hour.
Which is interesting, because, well, no, again, going back to Marx, he saw that this battle for productivity with workers, their labor time and all that, would inevitably produce an underclass. And do you see that in today's world?
Well, so in a way, we're beginning to get a class where people are time poor. You know, you have time rich and time poor. I mean, it's not saying that some people who earn a lot of money don't work a lot of hours, but if you get paid well, then you can use that money to kind of make up for it. And then, you know, you don't need to go home and clean your house. You can get someone to clean for you and pay them a proper wage or whatever. So I think if your wages are too low, then you end up with a sort of new kind of poverty, and that has a very big impact on society, I think.
I think it is. I think, you know, there's a study done recently where it said that the top 1% in the world from a economic level own roughly 85% of the world's assets.
Yeah, and they're going to end up owning a lot more of our time than they do as well.
Well, that's the whole thing. That's the whole thing. Now, one of the interesting things you bring up is the rise in self-service, which I find a wonderful euphemism. From, you know, scan it in the yourself in the supermarket checkouts to online travel bookings. Now, all of these things have been kind of couched as giving us more choice, more control, but you see it differently.
Well, I think self-service can be very useful at times. We've all done whatever, online banking while we're on holiday or something or over the weekend, but I think it's getting a little bit out of control, because especially when this year I'm noticing there's kind of little machines appearing everywhere where I'm invited as a consumer to do it myself in the name of more choice and more flexibility and it's more personalized, whatever. But these things add up. So you do 5 minutes at the bank and 10 minutes at the supermarket, and there you weigh your own fruit and then you check out your products yourself. Then you go on the internet and book a flight, and there's so many little instances that really add up. And so while I was making the film, I actually looked up this concept and I realized they actually have given us a name. The consumer who works in this way is called a partial employee. So we're actually part of a workforce. And there are economists who've studied this phenomenon. It basically, from the 1930s onwards, it's already in managerial literature. It's already there, kind of as an official concept. It's in the budget. And it basically means you have a chain of production. And this chain now finished a little bit earlier, and the last steps are done by the consumer. Another good example is like whatever, IKEA or something like that, for instance. You pay a little less, but then
you gotta build it yourself.
Finish the product. So you're part of the production chain in a way. And I'm not saying it's always a good or bad thing, but in a way I think we should be aware, because I can make a choice maybe and say, well, okay, I want to pay less and I kind of add 2 hours of my time. But I think we need to be aware of that mechanism. And I find it's kind of adding up a bit. There's quite a lot of this going every day. And the other day I got a letter from the gas board and it sort of said, well, we're not going to come around and read your meter anymore. Basically, you can either take a photograph and then upload that to our websites, or you can spend like 10 minutes in a call center queue and phone in your reading, whatever. One way or the other, they wanted, again, some of my time, and they're not sending their people around anymore. So they're saving jobs there.
Well, see, that's the thing that to me I find is interesting. We started looking at our day. You know, you get up in the morning and you head out and you start thinking, all right, well, if I got to put gas in the car, you know, you got to go fill the car up yourself. You know, there's not an attendant there anymore who washes your windshield, checks your oil, your tires, you know, who does all those basic things. You know, now you're doing it. Then you go online and you do all these other tasks. And the idea of being a partial employee says that from the company that's offering the service, they have a value in mind in terms of what they think they're saving in terms of the cost of an employee doing this work. But for the individual, you don't have a concept of what your time is actually worth and what it's costing you one way or another in terms of that time to perform these tasks as a partial employee?
Well, you could actually try and calculate it. There's a very interesting application on the web developed by somebody in New York, you know, the busiest city in the world, at least by reputation.
But it's truth.
A mathematician called Spencer Greenberg, he's developed something called the value of an hour calculator. Value of an hour calculator, you find it quite easily when you go on the internet. And there you can work out how much your hour's worth. So what you do, you see, I mean, it's quite basic. You add in how much you earn, how many hours you spend working. Maybe you also add your travel every morning and then in the afternoon on the way back or whatever. And then you get sort of roughly figure for your hour. And then it's quite surprising because then it makes it easier to make a decision. So you can say, well, maybe if I spend like 20 euros or more on a direct train that gets me about an hour earlier, is that worth it? Like, you know, if I get paid more than 20 hours, then maybe it's worth spending that money. So we can then look at buying us time with a taxi or with a train or with someone who helps us out, or you get someone else to do my accounts. I don't know. I can farm things out if they cost me less than what I earn, for instance. So it's a little tool. Obviously, Spencer's not trying to say you should apply that to all your friends and your family. Is it worth being with them? That would be ridiculous. But it's in a work context, I think it's an interesting and a little game, at least, to do with yourself and find out what, you know, how you feel about all of this. So this is free online. It's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that's also interesting that you're talking about that is that we're seeing, I guess downsizing of the worker today, where we have contract employees, where you are hired to do a job, but in effect, you don't get the benefits of a full-time employee. We've seen the European courts, you know, challenge people like Google, who have hired any number of independent contractors, but they're working 40 hours a week. And the courts have said, well, you know, these are full-time employees, and you have to pay them accordingly. So this whole idea of outsourcing time from a management standpoint is that it's a way of reducing the amount of benefits you're really paying to the employees. You're reducing hospitalization care, you're reducing vacation time, on the idea that, well, as an independent worker, you can control the time you spend.
Well, and the partial employee, in a way, is like the ultimate outsourcing project, in a way. That's, as you said, you get people being outsourced and then they have like fewer rights, but as a partial employee you really don't have any rights, really. You know, you don't get any holidays, you don't get any training beyond that. You know, you find yourself classic situation in front of one of these new machines and you don't know how it works, and then you have somebody from the company there who will sort of tell try this and try that, you know, where they will never touch the machine, they will make sure you learn how to use it. And there was also, it brings to mind that there was a court case, I think, that somebody took the Huffington Post to court because people said, we've been writing these articles for free and now we want a share of the profits. And I think they lost the case.
They did.
It was, I think it made people think because there was a lot of coverage. So there's kind of degrees. I think that's the partial employee, and there's of course things in between where, you know, your time gets really pressed while you're at work or where you're made to do lots of hours. And
but it's not moving in the right direction.
Well, it's all kind of moving that way, you know, as in, like, time's valuable and we can't afford it any other way. But I don't know. There's always two sides to each story.
Well, there's I always said in New York, we say there's three sides to a story. His side, her side, and the truth.
Well, yeah. You could try by applying to the boss and the worker and who else.
Well, we'd like to talk more with Cosima right after this.
Born to the woman in me is free. No, I
Candace Spring with "You Don't You Know the Need for the Real Thing." You know, in America, early in the 20th century, you saw the evolution of time and motion studies, ostensibly as a way to improve the productivity of workers, to standardize production, to give them better lives, etc. However, you have a different perspective on this. Tell us why.
Well, I think time and motion studies are really interesting because in a way that they started out as an industrial thing in 1910, 1920s, and then right through the century, things sort of evolved, and now we're almost doing sort of time and motion on ourselves. You know, we sort of start thinking, have I had a productive day? Could I have used those 10 minutes to do something else or quickly check my messages or whatever? So I think it's an interesting story, and it started with obviously people like Taylor, and then there was a really famous couple, the Gilbreths, Lillian and Frank Gilbreth, and they were really interesting because they're, apart from being really well-known efficiency consultants, I mean, their work's still being studied today, they also had 12 children, and they really wanted to have a big family, and they also thought, well, that's another way of demonstrating that it can be done. You can combine work and family and whatever. You have to be efficient. So what they did is they went to factories. I mean, the factories would actually pay them to come in, and then they would set up film cameras, which was like a really new, amazing thing to do at the time. They would turn up with these big movie cameras and sit workers down in front of a background, like a white background with a grid, and then they would develop the images and then run them slow motion and then look at every single motion. So basically each task would then be broken down into little steps. And then they would work out whether they could maybe reduce one step or whether they can drop a few movements. So they invented this whole vocabulary of movements. And then basically what time and motion basically means, you pick out these movements, the movements that you need, and you try and eliminate everything else. So that sounds quite mathematical, but it actually had very good intentions because our idea was to have higher productivity, obviously, but also they didn't want people to be as tired. You know, the idea was like, if, for instance, there was one example where you see a woman packing soap, and all the raw materials are sort of really chaotic on a huge desk, so she has to kind of lean over and stretch over, and some of the materials are even further away. And then when you sort of see the before and after films on the final version, everything's so close to her that she can even sit down, so she's no longer standing up, she's no longer bending over, and she manages to pack twice as many. So it's good for her back, and it's also good for her bosses. So it actually went really well. But the problem is, I think over the decades, this has kind of been taken to an extreme, and we now find companies where they're using time and motion studies to determine a sequence of movements, but they're also restricting people's lunch breaks, they're restricting people's toilet breaks. And I was shocked to find out that there's, for instance, in the United States, not just one, but a whole bunch of companies where basically you get exactly 7 minutes to go to the toilet, or you're allowed to go twice a week and everything else comes out of your wages. And that's like a sort of extreme efficiency where you wonder whether that's really still about efficiency or whether it's about power.
Oh, it's definitely about power. It's about power, and it's also about money. I think, you know, we've seen the same thing happen in the medical industry, where now doctors are being told that you have a quota of how many patients you must see in a day, how many tests you must order up, how much revenue you must generate. And if you meet the goals, fine, you get a bonus and all the rest of it. If you don't, you get dinged. So something as, to my mind, as intrinsic to life as healthcare is being monetized, then it doesn't surprise me that in the workplace we see the same things, you know, happening.
Well, they're basically treating us like a clock, like a machine. And I think we shouldn't forget that we aren't machines, because, but there's, of course, there's this link to industrialization. So people started setting up huge factories and bringing in big machines, and the machines were expensive. So you want the machines to run 24 hours. So you want the human operator to be there 24 hours, but we're just not the same. And right. I think, you know, you might restrict people's toilet breaks, but on the other hand, they're probably going to be working better and faster if they have had a little break. But some people just don't see it like that. I think some of the capitalist system is just run on these little Excel sheets, and then people on machines just get muddled in together, and time and everything's just like one big resource. And like the toilet story, the other thing that was interesting is that initially nobody wanted to believe me. So I said, well, yeah, maybe one factory in India or in Bangladesh. And then I started looking, and Oxfam America have actually done a huge report on fast food factories and states, poultry factories. So you got all these chickens kind of racing past, and then it's someone's job to cut off like the left wing or something. Right. And you can actually go through the century of that story, that these chicken assembly lines now go twice as fast as they used to, and there's no more toilet breaks. But I also found stories in the UK. For instance, there's Hazards magazine. They write a lot about trade union matters, and they've found a lot of kiddo. They have a whole page called Toilet Break News where people can write in with their stories. And in Germany, there was a lawyer. He was sacked because his boss basically said, well, you've been to the toilet this month for like, you know, 300 minutes or something. I mean, that's too much. And then the guy went to court, and they said, well, yeah, 300 minutes sounds like a very long visit, but if you split that down to each day, then that's like 10, 15 minutes or something. That's probably quite normal if you're allowed to have lunch or a cup of coffee or something. And then there was also a British journalist who went undercover at Amazon, and he said he found all these urine bottles between products because people can't cross the whole warehouse and go to the loo. That gets taken out of their wages, or it gets marked down. You know, you get you get into trouble for that. So people find other ways, and so it is actually happening. And interesting, when the
there's no question about it, it's happening all around the world. And I think, you know, famously, you know, Japan has always been seen as one of those countries where, you know, time is expected to be expended as part of the workforce and part of the workday. And you have the official, I put that in quotation marks, time that you spend in the office or whatever in the factory, but then there's time that you're expected to spend with your coworkers, which is all part of your being able to move forward in the organization and being perceived as someone who desires to move up. In the States, we've seen instances where people are encouraged not to take their vacations. Not that they have big vacations to begin with, but again, the fact that they're saying, you know, you shouldn't take your vacation, or we'll give you money to stay and, you know, work, you know, instead of taking the vacation. So, I mean, we're seeing these things really literally, as you mentioned, all over the world.
Yeah, does that, I mean, the US, there was actually a really interesting project for a while called Claim Back Your Holidays. And they were actually talking to individual companies saying, why don't you, you know, make people take their holidays and see what happens. You know, they'll come back with, you know, full of energy and with new ideas. And I think some people actually responded to that. But that project has now closed down. And
right.
I think it's also, we're kind of internalizing our boss's ideas in a way that we sort of feel guilty when, you know, they manage to make us feel guilty about not being there. And
yeah, well, I think one of the obvious impacts on our lives is that the idea of stepping off the treadmill to relax, have vacation, has somehow come to be seen as a negative, particularly in places like US and Japan. How can we fight this?
I think there's lots of little things we can do, but it's also not that easy because it's something that's happening inside our heads and it's coming in from the outside as well. So I think one first thing maybe would be to really separate work and free time more clearly, because I think at work we already have a lot of pressures, and that's where we need to fight for breaks and proper wages and all that. But I think we also should stop thinking that we're sort of at work in a way, you know, our own work when we're in our free time. You know, because a lot of the time we feel we have to be busy all the time, and doing nothing makes us feel bad in a way. You know, think I could have done this, I could have done that, I could have done that. And we always want everything really quickly also, and to sort of relax and, for instance, let new ideas come or whatever. That's sort of really going out of fashion, and
we need to give ourselves permission to relax.
In a way, yeah, we need to now go to a time management workshop and pay money for it so somebody can tell us, maybe, why don't you try having an hour of doing nothing every day and see what happens in your life? It's almost like, yeah, we need like an authority to tell us. And then, you know, once they do, I think it's quite easy to take on board. But there's a sort of guilt thing that, you know, we think there's time thieves and we are our own time thieves, and we you know, we think we should sort of always be productive every single second.
Well, I had the same thing because I had recently been on a program of losing weight, and part of it is going to a diet doctor. And you go in and you get weighed, and they, you know, in this case, use acupuncture or whatever. But I said, why am I paying 16 euros a week to step on the scale when I do it every morning anyway? And so to go there and then have them reconfirm what I already know somehow doesn't make sense. So let me put that 16 euros back in my pocket and just continue to do what I'm doing. So again, little trade-offs like this, we begin to realize what we're doing and what it's all about, or to minimize the time we spend for it.
Yeah, maybe you need the feeling I've invested an hour of my time to go and be weighed, and that makes it more serious or something.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, and I think that's probably, you know, part of the sale. Anyway, you're listening to 106.9 FM, Radio Canal Barcelona, English Radio Thursday. We'll be back to talk more with our guest right after this.
Me to treat you this way. I don't know why I did it, and I don't know why you'd stay. Don't know how to fix it. All I can do is say that I love you, then get down on my knees and to say. I don't know what possessed me to treat you this way. I don't know why I did it, and I don't know why you'd stay. I don't know how to fix it. All I can do is say then get down on my knees and pray. And I
And that was Amy Cervini with I Don't Know. Now, one of the things that I think has been lost is taking time for reflection, on being able to properly observe a situation, evaluate choices, make the appropriate choice. As we were talking about in the break, doing nothing oftentimes is doing something, because we're often investing our time in our futures and things that we want to happen. I mean, so much of what we are being charged with doing now is what we say back in New York, it has to happen in a New York minute. What do you feel about this?
Well, you know, your New York minute is, I think, is a good way of summing up this sort of stress out lifestyle that we want everything right now, and that we don't want to waste a second in our lives, you know, because we think we have to be productive. And there was actually an interesting study done by one of the characters in my film, Robert Levine. He's a sort of time historian, and him and his students went out and compared a lot of cities around the globe, and I think they set up a few things like, would you stop and help somebody, or how long does it take to buy a stamp, or would you help somebody and, you know, bring them something back that they've lost or something. So they invented a few basic situations and then did a ranking of cities, and of course New York was one of the fastest, where people took the least time. And there's also a study, a similar study by Milgram, who's very famous for his obedience experiment, but he also did one like, would you take the time to stop to help somebody? And that also is an experiment that's been done a few times, where, you know, there's somebody as part of the experiment pretends to be ill or something, be taken ill, and then people don't have time to stop anymore. The faster city, the less time we have for that. And I think it's not even that we don't want to help, but I think when you're pressed for time and you have a sort of deadline, you're running and there's a train waiting for you at the other end, then you become a different person, because you get tunnel vision. And that's the sad thing about time pressure. It's not only about the stress is actually not good for you, but we literally don't see people around us anymore. And which means time pressure, I think, it turns us into different people. And that's quite a big impact, and it's very sad sometimes.
Well, the thing is, looking in New York, you know, it is an impersonal city in many ways, but yet at the same time, when people are in distress, I find New Yorkers tend to rally around them. I mean, if you've people are walking down the street and you stop and say, you know, can you tell me? All of a sudden, four people will stop and they start giving directions. Then one will say, no, I know a faster way. And again, they converge. And during the blackout we had it back in the 70s, where all the power went out, people got out on the street, began to direct traffic, being able to find out if there was anyone sick, you know, they would need to get them to the hospital. People would, they set up chains to be able to get foodstuffs and medical supplies to people who were in distress. They were able to, I remember a story of a guy put a woman on his bicycle to get her to the hospital. So I think there is something about New York is kind of different from that, in that, yes, it is very fast-paced. It is very, very focused. But at the same time, when challenged, people tend to come out of that shell, out of that traditional road, and then maybe go back to that other time that they remember when people did help each other.
Yeah, I think it's almost like the sort of normal everyday stress maybe makes us a little bit blind to things. But when there's a real need, I think people rally. That's true. And maybe we need an emergency like that to remember what it's actually all about. And the fact that, you know, everything's so tightly planned, and because also to talk about solutions, we don't leave those little spaces anymore. If we're going to catch a plane, we're going to leave exactly enough time, or possibly a tiny bit less, to make it. Instead of maybe leaving a little bit earlier, and then maybe if there is somebody in need, you have time, or maybe you can chat quickly to your neighbour, or you see something, you think, oh God, if I will buy that newspaper, maybe have a look. I don't know. A tiny window for something unplanned to come in, because we have these sort of really tightly planned diaries. And I guess New York is probably the same, a bit like when I was living in London, for instance. I noticed that also when people meet, it's very tightly planned and it's very much in advance.
Right.
So a dinner would be planned like a month ahead. I don't know whether New York is like the same.
Well, New Yorker, you have that, but also we have dates where we program play dates for the children and all of that. So that, all right, on Wednesday at 4 o'clock, you know, Mary, Susie, you know, Virginia, they're going to bring their kids together to this person's house, and we're going to have a play date with the kids. They even have play dates with the dogs. You know, we'll meet our dogs, you know, and they'll all play together, and you know, it's a chance for them to, the people to socialize as well, but ostensibly it's a way of creating time for the dogs to be together. Yeah, it's New York.
I think it's really interesting that you mentioned children, because I think children have a different relationship to time, and I think we can learn from them. So on the one hand, you know, as soon as they start primary school, we don't only teach them whatever maths or how to spell, they're also being taught the clock, and that takes quite a while. Mm-hmm. And sort of you think, well, on the one hand, yes, then to function in modern society, you need to be able to stick to some kind of schedule, so you can also at such and such a time we're going to do this. But I always find it quite interesting that, and you know, children are being made to eat at 4 o'clock is now the time, mm-hmm. but maybe they're actually hungry before or later. Mm-hmm. So I think looking at what happens to children at that age when they're being taught the clock and how they respond tells us something about these sort of natural reactions that we've lost. So, like, for instance, in the film, there's mm-hmm. a little girl, the teacher sort of says, what do you think of the clock? And the little girl sort of says, it's funny, but some hours are longer than others. and the teacher's obviously heard this before, so she mm-hmm. says, my guess is that, you know, when you're out in the yard with your friends, that's really short, and then when you're back in class, it takes longer. But the subjective element is really, really important. And a clock can be like the most precise clock in the world. I mean, we have clocks that are down to like, you know, they're going to be correct for the next 150,000 years. It's still not the same as your internal clock. That will never be captured.
You know, I think there's an interesting corollary to that is that, you know, when you talk about the children, you know, we've gotten to the point where at an earlier age, even before preschool, we're introducing kids to devices where they have a little laptop computer. You have an educational tool where the kids are beginning to get involved with the gadgets. And then they, as they get older, they graduate to different kinds of gadgets, you know, more sophisticated computers, laptops, smartphones. And then we see them as teenagers, as adults, addicted to these devices, where they really can't separate themselves from it, and they're losing their time from almost the time they're in their cribs. Can we look to a time when we can become more disconnected, do you think?
Well, it's funny, but there's a start being made at the moment, funnily enough, online in a way that, you know, we all know we're addicted, we all know we spend too much time with our smartphones, and then suddenly there's all these little apps appearing that tell you, you know, you can program you so you can switch off, or you can put the phone far away, or the phone will make some funny noise when you don't stick to what you've agreed or something. So it's almost like there's a new generation of apps coming up. But on the other hand, the question, of course, is that a new market? You know, do we actually need that? It's like, you know, first you create a problem and then you sell a solution as well. And I think also it's not only just children, it's us ourselves. I mean, I've been reading all these articles about, you know, when some schools, for instance, there was a school in France that just basically said no mobiles in class. And then another school, they told me they had no mobiles during break and found that children were actually playing a lot more together again. And it doesn't really take that long to come off again. But there is, it's something that has to be a conscious decision.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, in the States, you even get, I can't remember now what it was called. It was a sort of camp work. It's like a sort of holiday camp for adults from Silicon Valley. And they go and instead of looking at their smartphones, they do silk printing and they make cupcakes and they go fishing. And so it's still there. I think something in us wants to get it back, but it seems we need these devices and programs to maybe get there.
Well, now, if our listeners want to be able to see the documentary, Time Thieves, how can they do it?
Well, it's actually going to be broadcast on Televisión Española next in Spain. I don't have the date yet, though. So,
well, you'll submit to me. We'll put it online.
I will let you know. And then also, you know, anyone's welcome to look me up on Facebook, and I'll always post things like that there. And, you know, yeah, it's going to be also in the newspapers and the TV program. But it's going to be broadcast at some stage soon. So that's the next opportunity on my Facebook and also on my Twitter. I usually put dates of festivals or special screenings.
And your Facebook page is?
It's my very complicated name, Cosima Dana Rizzo. So
Okay.
I'm sorry. It's so complicated.
Don't be sorry. It's a great name. We'll put the information up on our Facebook page so everybody know about it. And we'll be back for some closing comments right after this. Was Lee Ritenour with Countdown. Well, you know, talking about time, there's coming out of the documentary an emphasis in point about time in the Spanish workday versus time in the rest of Europe. Tell us about that.
Well, there's a story which basically started with Fabian Mohedano. He's a Catalan parliamentarian, and he basically wants to change the way Spaniards use their time. He basically wants people to free up more time. So we were sitting in the production office and sort of thinking, well, actually, what is the difference? Is it such a big difference between Spain and the rest of Europe? So we started having a look at Spain, and we looked at France-Germany, because it was a co-production with Arte, the France-German channel. So Polar Star Films at the production company, we were sort of trying to make up a split screen comparing the two. First of all the clichés came out. So it's like, oh, yeah, the Germans work all day, and which is not true. And the Spaniards have a siesta, they don't really work, which is also not true. And then we made up this sort of parallel montage, and that's where some of the differences became clear. So, for instance, in Germany, people start a lot earlier. So, and a lot of the time also you get a choice, so you might start at 7 or 8 or 9 at the latest. And a lunch break, maybe an hour or less, and then from 5 onwards, you're free. So you have this slot, maybe between 5 and 8 or something, when you have dinner to actually have a hobby. So a lot of people go and they go swimming or dancing or they go to language school or whatever, but they are kind of slots for activity. And in Spain, a lot of people start later. And then in mid-morning, you have a breakfast break. So it's sort of 10:30, which might be a good time to grab the Germans on the phone, for instance, if you have business there. But no, people go out and have breakfast. And then a lot of people have a much longer lunch break. And then, of course, they come back later and work. So they're doing just as many hours as the Germans or the French. But it takes them much longer to finish the day. So a lot of people finish at 6, 7, 8, whatever. And then when they get home, you still have chores to do, and it's much more difficult to squeeze in your hobby. So I think it's...
And that's why our dinner starts at 9:30, 10 o'clock.
Yeah, exactly. Then you have dinner late, and then, as Fabienne says, yeah, and then you have dinner late, and then you don't sleep as well, and you get up, and then, you know, you're not hungry, and then, of course, breakfast is later. And so you have a sort of desynchronization, which in the end means that the whole day is sort of busy, and it's very hard to find sort of slots for any activities. So he's kind of working quite hard on changing that, because, of course, he can't just say to one person, I want to do it differently. So, for instance, when we went to film him, we filmed him having breakfast. He says, I have breakfast before work, so I don't need to interrupt my morning. But that means it has to be quite early, you know, before school. But at least they're all together. So it's not just about having food in your belly and having energy, but it means getting up early and being together. And
that's a way of reconnecting with your family.
Exactly. He says it's also family time. So it's not really just about sort of reducing breaks or something. It's really about having time for family. It's for having time for your friends, having time for a hobby, and having chunks of time that also you can be, you know, be active as a sort of social being, whatever. And but of course, you can't just decide, I'm going to do that.
No.
Because maybe your company doesn't like it, or... if the shops are open until 9 or 10, then someone's going to be working there. So everybody would have to finish earlier. So it's very interesting. They call it the reforma horaria, a sort of time reform, and they want to do a time law. And they're doing this really nice experiment. So they're getting like one little town, for instance, to finish early during one day. So restaurants will offer dinner at 7 or 8. I mean, normally in a Spanish restaurant, you go in at 7 or 8 and the chef hasn't arrived yet.
Right.
You know, dinner's at 10. So they're doing these little tests. And I think in Barcelona also, the accident and emergency of the healthcare service, they kind of finish a little bit earlier so they can go home earlier. And I mean, obviously there's someone, you know, all around the clock for like really serious problems, but the idea is to kind of slightly make the working day slightly more compact, with less breakfast and lunch and all sorts of breaks, so you can get home earlier. Or some people also like it like that, to give people a choice. And I think that's maybe the key, that you, according to your family situation, you can say, as long as I do my 8 hours, can I come a bit earlier or later? Can I do a longer or shorter break? Maybe that's the answer. So
I think it's great. I think, again, it goes back, you know, to the question I really want to kind of close with, is that how can we reclaim our time? How can we reclaim our lives from the time thieves? How can we really begin to invest our time in ourselves?
I think, first of all, we need to really be aware of where time really goes. And maybe you do a little diary and write down, you know, where are my breaks? Am I spending too much time at work? Where's my time be stolen from me? Also, where are the services that I do, and maybe someone else could do them, even if I pay them for that? You know, I could make a conscious decision. I don't go to a place where everything's self-service. I go next door where you still have a person, and maybe it's not even that much more expensive. And if it's more expensive, well, maybe it's my choice. Also, it would be my right. I can calculate that. So I think we should stop occasionally, take a deep breath and say, even if I'm now doing nothing for 10 minutes, it's fine.
Right.
I'm allowed to do that, and maybe it gives me some ideas for later. But of course, it's a long struggle. I mean, it could be a personal thing. It's fighting our own demons and feeling less worried about our time, but it also might be voting differently. It might be getting involved in a trade union. It could happen on lots of different levels. It could be a decision that I work less hours and accept a smaller wage because I want more time.
all those
problem
things.
Is everybody has to make their own decision in a way, and the problem is we have to try and steal our time all day, so we have to make that decision several times a day. There's no blanket solution.
We have to steal some of our own time to be able to make time for ourselves.
Yeah, steal some time and think about your time.
Absolutely.
Maybe that's the way to do it.
Well, it's been great talking with Kasima today, and we wish you all the best in the documentary. You know, definitely try to see it, Time Thieves. Look at it for your paper. You will put it on Facebook and look at our Facebook page as well.
It's called Ladrones de Tiempo in Spanish, just so you know where to look out for it on Spanish television.
Perfect. Well, I'm going to leave you today with one of the great piano masters from Chicago. Where else? Ahmad Jamal with One. Have a great one, Barcelona. Grab some leisure time and come back to listen to us next week.